Up next, we have our book reading program, Ohomani Iyotaka, read by Gail Hubling.
The Long Knives Are Crying, a novel by Joseph M. Marshall III, Chapter 4, An Unseen Uneasiness. After the carcasses had been quartered, the hunters had to use 12 sturdy horses to transport the meat home, taking 2 days to return. They stopped twice overnight, and the loaded drag frames had to be arranged in the middle of the camp with several fires burning around the perimeter to keep the wolves and coyotes away. The hunters knew that neither they nor their meat were in any imminent danger from those four-leggeds. The fires and posted sentries kept them from getting too close and frightening the horses. The 16 buffalo hides were given to those who needed to patch their lodges or replenish robes, but the cold weather made it impossible to work on them. So although some preliminary scraping had been done by the hunters, the hides were rolled up tightly and allowed to freeze until the warm days of spring. The meat was distributed among the 9 winter villages of the Crazy Horse Band. Rabel guessed that, if used sparingly, the supply would be enough for 20 to 30 days. It was little in comparison to the large autumn hunts when meat could be made to last everyone through the winter, but whether or little or a lot, the people were happy to have fresh buffalo to eat. It had been a few years since hunters returned to any village with buffalo meat loaded on drag frames behind horses. If nothing else, that sight lifted everyone's spirits and invoked memories of good times past. Hawk Eagle stayed until the weather cleared. On a cold, bright morning, he finished his preparations to begin his long journey home. He wore his new elk hide coat, a gift from Crazy Horse and his wife, Black Shawl. His buckskin gelding seemed to sense that a journey lay ahead. His eyes were wide and eager, and his ears were alert. A tightly bundled buffalo robe was tied down across the horse's withers, and hanging down his left shoulder was the hide-encased rifle. On the opposite side lay the encased bow and a quiver of arrows and 2 folded rawhide cases, one filled with food and the other with Hawk Eagle's personal effects. A contingent of dogs and small boys watched him closely until Cloud, taken alive, Crazy Horse, and Yellow Wolf appeared, all bundled against the crisp morning air. Cloud handed him a bag of buffalo jerky. "Try not to eat it all in one day," he teased. "Your wife is a good cook," Hawk Eagle replied. "I just might." Crazy Horse handed him a long, slender bundle. Hawk Eagle knew it was one of his war arrows. "A message for your headman," Crazy Horse told him. "You can tell him that some of us will go east and meet you during the moon when geese return. None of us will be there later." Hawk Eagle nodded. "He will be glad to hear that, and I will be glad to see all of you again." Taken alive, tossed over a small bag that Hawk Eagle deftly grabbed in midair. "Bullets," explained the older man. "We decided that each of us could spare 1 or 2 just in case you run across some long knives. If you have to shoot any, tell them those are from us." Soft chuckles ran through the group of men. "I am grateful," the young man said, holding up the bag. "If I have to put my rifle sights on a blue coat, I will think of all of you." "Take care of yourself," Yellow Wolf called out as the Hunkpapa mounted. With a nod, smile, and wave, Hawk Eagle turned his eager mount east and urged it into a fast walk. After several moments, he was gone from view. Since he had arrived, a message from Sitting Bull was a topic of conversation throughout Crazy Horse camps. There was little disagreement with the Hunkpapa medicine man's intentions. Sitting Bull's attitude toward white people was well known among all the Lakota bands. He had always urged Lakota leaders not to sign any paper that the white peace talkers put in front of them. Of course, most had not listened, and now thousands of Lakota were living at the agencies. If you could call eating stringy meat from longhorn cattle and getting permission to hunt from a white agent of the Indian Bureau living. The fact that his people, like the Crazy Horse people, were not sitting on their hands at the white-controlled agency attested to his hard-line position. The only question in some minds was why he had waited so long to send out a call. Cloud and the other men lingered in the cold after the departing figure faded from view. Although none of them would admit it, they were sad to see the young Hunkpapa leave. He was the kind of young man who was easy to like. He smiled easily and worked hard. But there was something else. An uneasiness hung in the air this morning, accentuated somewhat by Hawk Eagle's departure. The successful buffalo hunt had been a bittersweet windfall. All of the hunters, to a man, were happy to have found fresh peat, but there was a nagging thought that they had further depleted the numbers of dwindling buffalo. Elk in large numbers were available, but hunting them was different. Buffalo moved in large herds, so autumn hunts usually yielded enough meat to last through a winter. Elk did not always move in large herds, and hunters had to travel deep into the mountains in the summer and fall to find them, and the yield was not as great, because elk could not be taken in large numbers. For the past 4 or 5 years, elk meat had been the staple for the Crazy Horse people, which meant that many of the able-bodied men were away hunting most of the time now. Starvation was not an imminent threat, but no man, woman, or child was even a little overweight. There were days, and there would be again, when a daily portion of meat was no more than a mouthful. Yet there was also the constant reassurance that sooner or later the hunters would bring home meat of some kind. But the uneasiness that hung in the air this morning had more to do with the future and the white people. Stories among the Lakota affirmed that whites had first come into the territory more than 100 years before. That was along the Great Muddy River, and the first Lakota to lay eyes on the strange newcomers were the Sichongu. After that, there had been a few more, mostly traders who, for the most part, had been friendly and harmless. 70 years ago, a group of them traveled by boat up the Great Muddy, and there had nearly been a fight when the boatmen took a young Lakota hostage. After an anxious day or two, they freed the hostage, then continued north and wintered with the Earth Lodge people, the Mandan. In the spring, a scout spotted the large wooden boat with the white wings going south, slipping past the Sichongu camps during the night. So whites had been part of Lakota life for several generations, but in the past 20 years the troubles with them, because of them, had become worse and more frequent as Lakota people died and Lakota lands were lost. Whatever else had been lost, Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull were determined not to lose their freedom. But one fact could not be ignored. Most of the Lakota nation had given up their freedom. They were now agency people, living under the control of the Long Knives and other whites. To some among the Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse people, that unsettling reality seemed to be a glimpse of the future. High Eagle, the medicine man, joined the group, his shrewd eyes sweeping over them. There was something on his mind. "I wonder," he said, "what the people at the agency think of Sitting Bull's message. It might be good if we can learn what Spotted Tail and Red Cloud people are saying, especially those who do not want to be there." "Why do you say that?" Crazy Horse asked. "Because we will need more than the few hundred warriors we have between us and Sitting Bull," the medicine replied somberly. "The Long Knives may not ride well or shoot straight, but they do not need to, because they can keep sending more and more, and because they have more guns and bullets." Crazy Horse nodded. "You are right, Uncle. Maybe we can send a man south to slip into the agencies and listen." Yellow Wolf stepped forward. "I will go," he offered. "My wife's sister is there. Her mother worries. Besides, she will know what has been happening." Taken alive, jabbed the young man's side playfully. "Maybe you should ask your wife first," he joked. The younger man grinned. "Plum will go with me," he said, "so she will not have to hide from you while I am gone." Taken alive grinned good-naturedly. When can you leave? Crazy Horse wanted to know. "Maybe yet today," replied Yellow Wolf. "Good," said Crazy Horse, nodding thoughtfully. "At this time of the year it might take you 10 days if the weather holds and there is no new snow." "When you get there," offered Cloud, "it might be wise to wait until dark and then go into one of the Spotted Tail camps first. Above all, the white agents or the Long Knives cannot know that any of our people are there." "We have clothes that will help us blend in," Yellow Wolf assured him, "and we will sneak in at night. It should not take us more than 2 or 3 days to hear what is happening." "Sitting Bull's messenger probably sneaked in," High Eagle assumed, "but I am sure by now that word has spread like a prairie fire. You will not have to listen too hard, I think." That evening, as the sun was going down, Hawk Eagle was making camp just below the head of a narrow gully. From the Crazy Horse village, he had traveled northeast, and by the time the afternoon light was fading, he was halfway to Elk River, or the Yellowstone, as the whites call the river, that eventually poured into the Great Muddy. He had covered a lot of ground thanks to the fast-walking Buckskin. When Hawk Eagle had stopped late in the afternoon and found the secluded gully, he picked it because it was far off any trail used by man or beast. He put the finishing touches on a heat reflector shaped like half a tiny lodge and fashioned out of dry brush. Not only did it direct the heat in one direction, it would also partially hide the glow of the fire once the sun went down. After he gathered kindling and then enough fuel to last through most of the night, he started a fire using a flint and striker. Choosing not to cook any of the meat he had, he began boiling water for tea. The smell of cooking meat might attract beings, four-legged or otherwise, that he did not want to encounter. While waiting for the water to boil in the metal cup, he worked on a sleeping shelter. He did not want anything elaborate, just shelter from the wind. Voices came on the breeze as he worked. Coyotes and wolves were already starting their nightly hunts. An easy stone's throw away, the buckskin was busy browsing the grass, chewing noisily and pausing to glance curiously toward the distant sounds of barking and baying. Unconcerned, he returned to browsing. By the time the sun was below the western horizon, Hawk Eagle had settled in for the night. He reclined on a bed of grass and twigs and chewed on a piece of jerky, taking an occasional sip of the peppermint tea. He had left the Ogallala camp reluctantly. Cloud had invited him to stay the winter, but he had already been away from home for 33 days and did not want his grandmother to worry any more than she already had. He chewed on the buffalo jerky Sweetwater Woman had made for him. He had not expected to see a white woman among the Ogallala people, especially the Crazy Horse band. But when Cloud had told him the story of how his wife had come to living among them, it was easy to understand the circumstances. The red-haired woman was a Lakota in every way, that much was easy to see. Sitting Bull and his nephew Gall had told stories of Crazy Horse, who was outwardly quiet but inwardly the fiercest warrior among the Lakota, according to Sitting Bull. That was why Hawk Eagle was still puzzled over the incident with the crow, Broken Hand. Crazy Horse had not only given him almost an entire buffalo, he had also returned the rifle, a very good repeating rifle the crow had traded for the meat. But times were hard for all human beings because of the white people. Hawk Eagle also wondered if the Ogallala headman's calling to be a Thunder Dreamer had something to do with the kindness he showed an enemy. Thunder Dreamers were supposed to act in ways that other people would not or could not. Kindness toward a crow was certainly the last thing any man would expect from a Lakota warrior who showed no quarter to those ancient enemies on the field of battle. Hawk Eagle shrugged to himself and looked around. Day was fading fast. In a while, he would tie one end of the long picket rope to the buckskin's ankle and the other end to his own ankle. Then if the horse wandered too far, he would know it. But all good Lakota horses were trained to the picket rope. They knew it meant they were to stay close to their riders. His thoughts returned to Crazy Horse and the others, especially the men he had hunted with. He liked them and had come to respect them. If only there were 10,000 more like them, then they could drive the whites out easily. But he wondered if that would bring the buffalo back. Still, if no more whites also meant no more buffalo, he was willing to live with that. With a sigh, Hawk Eagle leaned forward and dropped more wood onto his fire. There was a long, cold night ahead, not to mention all the cold days of travel before he reached home. But he had agreed to Sitting Bull's request, knowing that he was also agreeing to a long, hard journey. And there was another reason. He had wanted to meet Crazy Horse. He had not been disappointed. Gall and Black Moon, both accomplished warriors themselves, had likened Crazy Horse to a small whirlwind that could grow into a tornado. Hawk Eagle was at first taken aback with the man's quiet demeanor, but there was an air of strength and self-assurance that was just below the surface. It reminded him of his grandmother's admonition never to antagonize a mountain lion. Hawk Eagle smiled and added several small pieces of wood to the fire. With such men to lead them, the Lakota could drive out the whites, and the sooner the better, he thought. 2 days' ride to the south of Hawk Eagle's camp, another pair of Lakota hands put wood on a low fire. Yellow Wolf stirred the glowing coals. The shelter he had built was somewhat more elaborate than the one Hawk Eagle had put up. They had found a natural opening in a chokecherry thicket, and he wove long sturdy twigs into it to fashion a windbreak. The branches of the thicket also diffused the firelight a bit. From their village, he and Plum had ridden west and then turned south before they came to the Powder River Road, the road the whites once used and called the Bozeman Trail. No whites had used it since the autumn after the wagon box fight, which occurred the summer after the battle in the Hundred of the Han. Yellow Wolf had been 19 that winter and Plum 11. Her memories of that time were not as detailed as his, so she asked a few questions as they rode along. His answers were brief, and she sensed that he did not want to talk much about either of those battles. He did briefly mention Taken Alive being wounded in the wagon box fight, and his friend with the one arm being killed at the Hundred in the Hand. She remembered where the Long Knife town with log walls had been. Her father had taken her there a few years back. She recalled that there was nothing left but charred wood. In the late afternoon, they found a secluded bend near a frozen creek and made camp. The shining mountains were a wall of jagged shadows to the west, one long line of darkness. Plum handed her husband a cup of tea and a small bowl of pounded buffalo meat mixed with berries and tallow. It was a staple for hunters and warriors traveling in the winter. "Good," he said in appreciation. "I was hoping for this." "I brought plenty," she told him, "depending on how much you eat each day, that is." Yellow Wolf chuckled. "We will make it last," he assured her, "but it will not be easy." She smiled and then glanced out into the growing darkness. "I am glad you brought me along," she said. "I would not have come without you. This is one time we can travel together." She busied herself putting away the food, her face growing serious. After a moment, she sighed. "What do you think life will be like for our children?" she asked. "When we have children, that is." "My grandmother is afraid there are hard times ahead for us." This was a worry that was often on Plum's mind because she wanted children. Yellow Wolf stared into the deepening dusk. "Who knows what will happen in the years ahead? Maybe your grandmother is right. I hope not, but then I think that is why Sitting Bull is sending out his messengers, because he sees hard times ahead if we do nothing." "Will we all have to live at the agency?" she fretted. "Not me, not you, not our family," he replied with cold determination. "I was born free and I will die free. So will our children." Plum looked at her husband. She believed in him because of the fire of determination that burned in him. She believed he would do everything to stay free and away from the agency. Whether or not he could stop the future from turning bad, she did not know. "It is strange, then, that we are going to the agency," she pointed out. "Yes, it is, in a way," he agreed. "We will not be there long. Our headman is curious about what our relatives down there think of Sitting Bull's message, but Cloud warned me not to reveal ourselves to too many people." "What will happen in the spring? Do you think many of them will go to the gathering?" she wondered. "I mean, they will have to leave the agencies, and if that happens, what will the Long Knives do?" Yellow Wolf slowly shook his head. "I do not know," he replied, almost to himself. That is the strange thing, because there are far more Lakota at the agencies than there are Long Knives, or all the whites put together. They could overrun the whites at any time. I wonder about that all the time. Why are people just stay there as if they are in a corral like those longhorn cattle? Some kind of unseen power keeps them there. My brother-in-law, my sister's husband's younger brother, came up here last spring, remember? He said it was easy to slip away, Plum said. Yes, he allowed. It is for one or two people, but for 10 or 20 or more, it may be more difficult. A cold breeze crawled along the watercourse and shook the leafless branches of the thicket and made the flames sway over the coals. Plum turned to glance toward the horses picketed behind them, between the thicket and the low sandstone ledge. My mother said to bring my sister and her family back with us, she told her husband. I hope they will listen to us. Who knows, he replied, but I too hope we can talk them into coming back with us. I think we can. The resonant song of a wolf rose on the breeze somewhere in the foothills to the west, reassurance that not everything had changed. And that concludes chapter 4.
This program is made possible by funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.